Hello and welcome to Resettled, the ECDC ACC podcast. This episode is brought to you by Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield. This month, I spoke with Luol Mayan. Luol is one of the most remarkable people I've ever known. He's a refugee from South Sudan who taught himself to code and design video games in a refugee camp in northern Uganda. He has since become a video game designer, the CEO of his own company, and the founder of a foundation devoted to bringing technology to refugees. He has partnerships with organizations like Facebook and Coursera, and he has been interviewed by seemingly every major news organization in the world. His story is one of resilience, determination, creativity, and entrepreneurial spirit. He's one of the most amazing people I've ever known. You're going to love this episode. Let's get started. Hello, my friend. It's lovely to speak with you. How are you today?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me. I've been excited to be part of this conversation for sure.
Absolutely. It's so wonderful to speak with you again. I know it's been a while since we have, and it's great to see you.
I mean, it was like one of my favorite interviews, like the one we had, like it was like 2 years ago. Like it was like, I listened to it and the way you just described, even like the morning that we met, it was just, I just felt it. Actually, one of the interviews that pushed me so much to work so hard to, like, you know, sometimes when I look at things like that, I just feel like, wow, like there's something more to life. There's something more that we can always do. And it was really an honor for me to like have that conversation in the past with you. So I can't wait for this now.
Yeah, I know. It was fun thinking back to that previous conversation we had those years ago. And I remember that day being so cold.
Yeah.
But it was fun. So anyway, so so what I'd love to do is to begin by just asking you to tell our audience where you and your family are from.
Well, yeah. So my name is Luol Mayan, and I'm originally from South Sudan. So my family, they are South Sudanese, and we moved to Uganda, to northern Uganda. That's where I grew up as a child because of the war and the conflict that happened in South Sudan a long time ago. So I spent most of my childhood in Uganda. My family as well in Uganda because of the conflict, they became refugees in Uganda. So sometimes I would definitely say that, you know, Uganda is like my second home. Uganda is like my second home. South Sudan is my first home. That's where, like, you know, I was born on the way as my family was fleeing the war. But then most of the time, my other two siblings, actually, like, they were born actually in the refugee camp in Uganda. So sometimes they would call themselves, you know, we are Ugandan, you know, because that's where they were born. But so that's about me. And then the other part is, like, I'm the CEO of Juno Game. Juno Game is a video game company that uses the power of game to bring the global communities together. And I'm also the founder of Luol Mayan Foundation. So it's my initiative that I started recently, so I can't really talk more about it later on. But currently, I came to the United States in 2017, and then left my family back in Uganda. So, but after like 2 years, my family was able to move to Canada. So right now, everybody's in Canada. So yeah, that's all about my family. Yeah.
Well, I remember, though our audience, of course, won't know, but when we had spoken several years ago, when we first met, I remember they were still in Uganda, and that was something that was weighing upon you that they would be able to leave. So it's been, so when did they make it to Canada?
In 2019, actually, July. So July is one of my favorite months ever, because I came to America in July, and then they also came to Canada in July 2019. Yeah, it was really because, you know, for me as somebody who was an entrepreneur and coming back to the state, you know, it was my dream, or it was something that I really wanted to be able to, like, you know, give my family a new environment, because these are people that have spent the rest of their life, almost 25 years, in a refugee camp. And, you know, when I first came here and when I met you, like, that was something I'm thinking about every day. You know, I live here, and then looking back at my family, they are in a refugee camp, they're also suffering. So, and I'm like, you know, what is the point of me living here when I see my family, you know, not having the right resources? So I work so hard to connect with the right people to help me, you know, give me resources to find out, you know, what are some of the things that I can be able to do? Because it was a very bad year, especially politically as well, when it comes to refugees, you know, when it comes to policies, immigration policies, you know, for people to move from Uganda to come to, you know, to America, things like it was so hard. It was a priority for me to be able to find a place where I can be able to be able to move my family. So now I was able to make that happen, and that really helped me with my journey, because I'm no longer thinking about, you know, how my family are doing. You know, I'm thinking about, okay, more, it's a growth process. You know, I'm thinking about myself now. What can I do to be able to grow my company? What can I do to be able to more than now thinking about my family? Because there's something sometimes that put us in a situation where we don't even keep growing, because family is almost there. So if your family is in the same space, it helps you to actually think about other more things. So, yeah.
Where are they in Canada?
They're in Toronto. Yeah.
All right. They've been there for now, coming up on about 2 years.
2 years, almost.
Are they enjoying? Do they enjoy it? What do they make of Canada?
It's good. I mean, it's good. Canada is really good. Reason is because the community there is good. It was their first time to be able to come to an environment like that. You know, so Canada is good. You know, the healthcare system is good. Educational system is good, especially for my brothers. They're going to school there, you know, they're studying, they're they look like they've been in Canada for 10 years now. So they're enjoying it, you know, they sometimes they look at me and then, if you all can do it, we can also do it, you know. We have the resources that we didn't have now, so they're not here to play or do something like that. You know, I always tell them, you know, it's not easy, you know, it's a work. So yeah, they're enjoying it. My mother's doing well. She's happy as well. I remember the first time she came to Canada, the first thing she called me in the morning, and she was like, you know, I've been so happy. She was so happy to be able to in Canada. And you know what she told us? She told me, she was like, there's a lot of food here. I wish I can send it back home. And I was like, yeah, that's how, you know, there are people suffering somewhere, but there's enough somewhere. But, you know, that's how the world is. And I'm glad she thought about that, because, you know, she thought of people that she left behind. She had friends, you know, she had family members that are still there. And then coming here, there's abundance of things that you already missed before. And then you kind of find them. Yeah.
So how has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted your family? Because I imagine you have not been able to see each other at least since then, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it has affected a lot of people, especially when it comes to families, actually. It has affected a lot of people when it comes to when the families kind of far from each other. You know, there's no way, you know, across the countries to be able to travel and get to see them. Second to that is that, you know, for them, it was like the first year for them to be in Canada, and then something big like that just happened. So it was so hard for them to navigate even. So yeah, so I had to be very careful with that and be able to be the resource for them to tell them the thing that they have to do. And the advantage for that was, you know, they were in Canada. The way Canada was handling the COVID situation was really good. So that did not, you know, scare me a lot, you know. That did not scare me a lot. But yeah, that's why I chose a place like Canada, because stuff like that sometimes can be overwhelming. So you need people the way we handled it in America before wasn't really good. So yeah. But
yeah,
it's
no
affected
doubt.
Everybody, yeah. But they're staying healthy, they're fine, and nobody's been, you know, yeah.
And do you have a sense of when you'll be able to see them in person again? Or is that still just unknown?
Yeah, I mean, when the borders are open, maybe before the end of the year, I'll definitely go there and see them. I miss them a lot. Yeah, especially my brothers. I can't go away and play.
Yeah, of course. So now you've mentioned, I know we've been talking a little bit now, and you mentioned the conflict that prompted your family to move from South Sudan to Uganda. And actually, I imagine at the time it was Sudan, not South Sudan.
Yeah.
So I wonder, for our audience, can you talk a little bit about your family's time in Sudan and the conflict that drove them to Uganda?
Yeah. So yeah, that's a very good question. as I mentioned, that I grew up in Uganda as a refugee, and a lot of people would be like, you know, by how, like, because the refugee, you know, become refugees for so many reasons. Others with climate change, others for conflict, others for, like, you know, things that would actually force them to be able to look for a place of refuge, you know. And particularly for my family was affected by the civil war in Sudan. So, you know, the civil war started a long time ago, and then it reached my family in 1993. So when it reached my family, it was really so hard for them. Like, it was like, it became like almost a tribal war, you know, where, like, you know, thousands of people were killed. So, like, my family had to, like, even, like, you know, just, like, walk and, like, you know, flee from the violence, walking from, you know, just in the bush, trying to find a place where they can be able to live, you know, be able to find a place of refuge. So even my father had to take a different route, you know, because, like, you know, if a woman and a man are, you know, fleeing together and they are ambushed, and then all of them won't survive. So by some time when they find a woman with the children, sometimes they may have, you know, sympathy and leave them. So my father had to take, like, a different road. And then when they went to Oshawa, that's the place I was born, which is actually a border between South Sudan and Uganda. And it's a place that has a lot of stone and all those things. So I was born on the way. And it was like almost 250 miles, you know, for them to, like, you know, flee the war. It took them, you know, days and things like that. There was no water. There was no food on the way. It was like, as I almost mentioned, like, it was like a journey of life and death. Like, it was like a journey where, like, you don't know what tomorrow looks like, you know, you don't know what the next 1 hour looked like. And sometimes when my mother described it, it was just horrible. It was just like, nobody deserved to be in that space on the thing that they have never imagined they would be able to come. You know, like, they did not imagine to wake up in the morning and, you know, finding themselves in the bush running away from the land that they love, from, you know, they were farmers, you know, they were keeping kettles, you know, they were happy with what they already have. That was a home for them. So, and for them to make that decision, it was really, really so hard, you know, and it affected everybody, you know, and it affected even my mother. Even she got back on the way, you know, two of my sisters, you know, did not make it, died on the way because it was so hard for them. So it was just crazy. It was just like, the war itself has really affected a lot of, you know, people, a lot of South Sudanese, poor community and all this stuff. And that's how it became like a tribal conflict, you know, that was actually ignited by Bashir, by, you know, the Sudan government during that time. So that was before the comprehensive peace agreement. Yeah.
You mentioned that your family were farmers. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about their life before the conflict? Because you said they were cattle farmers and
yeah,
but they were respected members of their community and they had a home and a life. And sometimes I wonder if when we talk about people fleeing from conflict, we sometimes forget about the life that they had before and the life that was taken from them. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, and that's really a very good question. I'm glad you asked about it because, like, it's not everybody that, like, really asked that question. And those are the things that we really have to talk about, because, like, you know, the life before the conflict, you know, it's a life that you deserve. It's something that was born of you, you know, and when my family, you know, we have a very big community, like, you know, and those communities have different cultures, and those cultures, they are in a land that they already know, like, you know, what do they do to be able to survive life. It's not just survival, but living life there. For example, like, from my community, like, where we come from, the place is called Bor, and the reason is because, like, it floods every year, and that's why the flooding comes every year. That's why it's called Bor. So, like, it's when it floods, there's water, there's stuff like that. So the only thing they can do is, like, they do fishing. You know, some of them do fishing. Some of them were cattle keepers. Like, my dad used to have, like, you know, He had more than, like, maybe 200 heads of cattle. You know, it was like a very, that one alone, that was like, that one alone is someone that is respected in the community. Someone that had resources, all the resources. my mom's side as well. You know, my my mom's side, my grandfather was also like a keto keeper. He was like having a lot of kettles, you know, everything like that. And even when my father and my mother met, you know, during that time, you know, and this is something like, you know, especially in my community when it comes about, you know, empowering women, you know, like it was so hard during that time because women are people that, you know, for them, what they have to do is like maybe go in a house, things that they can be able to do. But then my mother was like, she was like working so hard in a way that even my father used to live with her at their home. So it was really so hard. Like it was like, it was just an amazing life that, you know, they would be able to like tell me every time. And that's a lot of people ask me every time, like, why do you talk about your mother every day? Because of like, you know, the hard work that she has done, like in our life, or even before I was born, even like I used to hear stories, even like in South Sudan before the war, they were working together, collectively together, you know, to be able to like raise a family. So it was like, for them before the war, it was like, that's the memory. That's the whole thing that they talk about, you know. You know, that's the, you know, that's what they deserve. But then in the morning, you see like the conflicts coming that you don't know is coming. And then you leave what you love, you leave all your kettles, you leave all like, you know, land, you know, you are growing crops and things like that. You just leave everything there and then head to a place that you have no idea whether you're going to reach or not. So it was like, it was a life for them. It was a beautiful life, you know. Even every time, like right now, my father asked me, like, I want to go back, you know, I want to go back there, you know, like, because that's the life that he has lived, you know. So, yeah.
I can't imagine having to leave all of that. That, like you say, this is a family that has built a beautiful life and is respected in a community, and then simply has to leave and abandon that. And the degree to which a family would have to feel almost lost or adrift, I can't imagine that. So how long did it take them to make the journey from where they had lived and in the community that they had to getting down to Uganda?
Yeah, that's a very good, I'm pretty sure it took them like at least, the journey pretty sure like took them about 2 years actually.
2 years, wow.
Yeah, almost, yeah, it took them because like they were like, you know, that war like was like, you know, they moved from like Fumbor. And then they had to like, you know, sometime like on the way, and then they will rest for like a month. Then tomorrow morning, there is also another, you know, it was like so hard for them. It was really hard. Yeah.
Do you know if there was a moment, a specific moment when they decided that they had to leave? Was there something that occurred that made them decide this is the moment, we have to leave now? Or was it something that was slower and they sort of saw coming and they could make a decision?
Yeah, that's a very good. There was no time for decision. It was like, it was just like, you know, it's like for them was like, even some, like it was like something just for card, like, you know, people, like the only decision you have to make is to find out where are your children? Where are your family members? That's like the only time that you have. And sometimes you don't have to even meet them, you know, as long as you have your children and then you have like, you know, the younger one, you just pick them up and then go on the way. So it was just like, it was just like there was no time for decision, you know. The time for decision making was during the journey. So that's where like I know that, hey, seeing we are moving from here to another place, we need to avoid, maybe just they can just predict where where there are rebels or where they're like, you know, where they have hard guns and stuff like that. So they would go somewhere and rest. And then and that's where like when they reach Oshawa actually. When they were resting, and then I was born during that time. So it was like it was so hard for them. Yeah.
So they arrived in Uganda. You said probably about 2 years later.
Yeah.
How long did it take before your mother and father found each other?
Well, that's actually I'm pretty sure. I think a year later, maybe.
Oh my. Like,
Yeah, a year later, yeah. I mean, but that was not that was like not too bad because there were families that actually could actually take almost 4 years to reunite. There were families that could not even have, you know, don't reunite again because like, you know, like their family members being killed or things. Like, it was just so hard, yeah.
Of course. Mm-hmm. So your family was this respected family of means and living in this beautiful life. And then they arrive in a refugee camp. Have your mother and father talked to you about the experience and what maybe the emotional experience was for them in going from having so much to having so little and being in a camp? Have they talked about that?
Well, that's it. I mean, they used to talk a lot. Like, I mean, like they used to talk about like the thing that they really, you know, they would tell us stories, you know, they would tell us stories, like, you know, the thing that they own, the thing that, you know, and the life that they left, that beautiful life that they left, that they love, you know, and the people that they actually know that were actually, you know, didn't make it during the journey. It was just, as I mentioned before, even I lost my two sisters during the journey, you know, so it was just, to them, it was really hard for them. It was really hard for them. And one thing that I really enjoy about my family was like this, the opportunity for them to let that go and began to like build something in the refugee camp. I mean, like when I talk build something, build a different mindset that kind of help us as children, you know, and then keep that. They did everything within the refugee camp. My mom used to like also try to be a farmer, to be able to grow crops and things like that. So being able to like start a new life was really something that really inspired me so much for my family. Yeah. But it was like, it was a very hard life for them. You know, it was just so hard, you know. Yeah.
Can you tell the audience which refugee camp it was that your family ended up settling in?
Yeah. So we, first of all, like after that, we went to Mogali. Mogali was a refugee settlement. That was like the after Ashura, and then we stayed there. But then in Mogali, you know, we had to like again leave because of the LRA, the Law Resistant Army. So in Uganda, so they start like killing refugees and stuff like that. I think most people know about that. And then we had to like move to northern Uganda. So yeah, so that's then we like, grew up in Baypi, you know, then we used to move, like, because there's a lot of refugees, so we used to move from different refugee camp to different one, Bidi, in Baypi. So we moved to, like, at least 3 to 4 refugees, yeah.
Different camps. Goodness, I wasn't aware of that, or I don't remember that from previous conversations that we've had.
Yeah, yeah.
For the audience, and I know we don't want to go down this yeah. track too far, but can for the audience, you mentioned the Lord's Resistance Army. Can you take just a minute, and for someone who may not know, can you tell them just a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the Lord Resistant Army was a very, very dangerous, resistant movement that happened in Uganda. It was around 2000, actually, from 2000 to 2005. Actually, that's like up to 2003. So for them, like, they were like fighting against maybe the government. I have no idea why they were. Then they were targeting people from northern Uganda. So, and they were, I'm pretty sure there's a lot of documentaries people can be able to find about that. Right. It was like the worst, like, you know, rebel leader ever. Like, you know, because like he had no mission. He was just killing innocent people, refugees. It was like, it was crazy. Like this story, like I remember one day, they almost actually arrested my sister she was coming from Numali. And then from there, like, you know, my sister, like, you know, immediately when my sister leaves, because she was like riding a bicycle, and then he saw them, and then like other people that were coming after her were arrested and taken by the Lord's Resistant army. And then it was so bad, like the way they would just beat people up, kill them, you know, recruit them, you know, cut the ears. It was like, it was so bad. And I remember that in 2003, I remember my mother coming and say, hey, everybody's leaving. She was like, we're going to another refugee camp. And I was like, why? Like, everybody was like, why? My dad was not happy with it, with the decision. She was like, yeah, I'm not feeling safe here and we have to leave. So we left the refugee camp the next day. And then the following day, they came and actually burned our house down. It was crazy. I don't know, like, I don't know how did even my mom, like, just have that, you know, I have no idea. Like, and then we left that refugee camp because we were living. Actually, our house was just next to the river. So, and then it was like the next house. And then we left in the morning, and then they came over the next day after we left. They burned their house down. They actually, like, even some of my friends that I knew I grew up with killed by them. It was just, you know, there's a thing that sometimes I don't talk about them, but like, it was just so crazy, you know. So especially like, and those are the things that refugee face sometimes. It's more than just, you know, being in a refugee camp or even just fleeing your country. So wherever you go, whatever is affecting that community is still going to affect you. You know, like, you know, the Lord's resistant army was not going to be saying, hey, these are like South Sudanese refugees. They were actually killing, you know, Ugandans, actually Northern Ugandan. But then there were refugees there. They just start like killing everybody. So it was like, it was a very bad moment. So just feeling that you flee the war and then you came back to another place that has a war. It was just crazy, you know.
Yeah. Your story becomes more complex and fascinating and difficult every time we talk about it. Mm-hmm. I can certainly appreciate that these are probably not things you talk about all that much. And thank you for sharing them, though, because I think it provides people with insights mm-hmm. and depth that they need so badly, and that I need certainly so badly to hear. The willingness have to do that
thank
is amazing.
You. Thank you. And yeah, I think that's really like slowly by slowly you get to feel comfortable and talk about things. And I think because the reason is it's for people to understand the journey. And I think that's where even my inspiration comes from. You know, slowly by slowly, I think the biggest thing that we can do as a society is to have empathy. And empathy is something that is built on experiences. You can hear experiences, the experiences that you cannot live them because you're in a different environment. But if you are an open-minded person or a policymaker or something like that, the only way you can be able to engage is to listen, is to also understand what the journey is like. Because if you don't know what the journey is like, you're going to be like, okay, the world is flat. Everybody's the same. Everybody's not the same. Everybody has different journeys. Everybody has different experiences. Refugees have different experiences. Refugees themselves have faced different experiences, right? So, and that's why, like, you know, things like this are the things that make us who we are as human. It's all about, like, you know, the journey. It's all about understanding what, you know, and that's where when I'm making my game, I'm like, okay, what is my mission? You know, what do I want people to understand or learn from this? When I'm sharing my story, it's like, you know, what is somebody going to learn from this? What are they going to take away from this? You know, and as we're talking about this, and I'm glad that, you know, the center is able to do podcasts like this, because I think it's something that enlightens us, is actually, you know, as people from the continent or everything, or immigrant or everybody around the world, that, you know, we have different stories to tell. We have different experiences, and we can use those experiences to be able to create a sustainable future for other people. Right? You know, my experience is my experience. I don't want anybody to experience it. But what am I doing about it so that somebody doesn't experience it? Because this is the same thing that is going to happen. You know, I just talked about the Lord's resistant army. But what can we be able to do about it? It's not done. I'll just talk about refugee crisis. It's not done. It's not going to get done. But what am I doing as a person that has experience in that? What are we doing as a diaspora to be able to help people back home? You know, as I talk about the story of my mother when she came to Canada, she was like, wow, there's a lot of food here. What are we doing about it to be able to, like, give the people that she lived with to get that food, that enough resources? You know, we live in a, for me, I call myself so privileged right now. So, because, like, you know, like, I'm not the only person. There are over 78 million refugees around the world. What have I done to be where I am today? I've worked so hard, yes. But, you know, what can I be able to do that, you know, we can be able to, like, you know, share stories, be able to, like, so that the community does not, or the society does not look at refugees as a burden to the society. at themselves, because the people, the only way we can do about that is when you do it, you know, sharing the experiences. And I think that, you know, I think that it's very important that, you know, when we talk about the thing that I experienced and talking about them and, you know, and highlighting people and telling people the depth of it, you know, the inside of it, or so that people can never sit back and just say, oh, wow, this is something that, you know, that they have to go through. Yeah.
You mentioned your game just a second ago, and I really want to talk a lot about your game. However, to get to the game, it's, I think, important to talk a lot, at least a little bit about how you came to be able to create games and your background and how, because that part of your story is, I mean, I think in life you talk to a lot of remarkable people and you meet people who are interesting and do interesting things. This part of your story is among the more remarkable things I've ever heard across anyone I've ever known. So can you talk a little bit? So you're living in a refugee camp. Can you talk a little bit about your introduction to games?
Yeah, that's thank you. I mean, it's, and I think sometimes I just ask myself sometimes, okay, like I'm just putting myself where I am today, like in Washington, D.C. right now. And I'm like, you know, have I ever imagined that this is something that is actually going to get me here? No. And I ask sometimes the best things is that, like, I remember when I was a kid, you know, when I was in the refugee camp, I was so creative. That's one thing I can remember. I can assure people that, at least that it doesn't matter where you are, there is that human talent. So when I was a kid, growing up in a refugee camp, I think the only thing we used to do is like waking up in the morning, go play football. There was no good school, maybe go to the butcher and get like mango tree, mango fruits and things like that. Those are like the few things that we can be able to do back in a refugee camp. But other than that, as I was growing up, I was really so creative. I remember I would get boxed. I would get like box, and then I would create actually like I would create a screen, like a screen out of a box, and then I would put a paper bag on the box, and then in the evening I would use a candle, and then people would actually come back home, and then they watch the movie that I actually created. Like, you know, I would create scene, I would cut them, and then people would look at the shadows. Like over 50 people could come every evening to my household, like in my environment. Maybe we'll sit down. And then I'm just like, and you're watching like a cartoon movie that I created using boxes from the screen that I made at night. And it was like one of the best entertaining thing. You know, everyone was like, when is the next show? And then like, and I would just go and create stuff. So I was like, when I was born, there was that creativity in me. Like, that's something I would say, there was that creativity. But then I remember there was a refugee registration. So they were registering new refugees. And then my family was calling for the registration. And then during that registration, that was around 2008-2007. During that registration, they were, you know, they were like by the UNHCR. So they were using computers during that time. And then I went, so we were in the line. And then I saw this person was using a computer and I was like, wow, what is that? Like, I've never seen something like that. I'm seeing somebody using it. So I asked my mom, they're like, what is that? And she was like, that's a computer. I'm like, how did you even know it is a computer? You've never been to school. So that's a moment that I, that was my first time seeing a computer in 2007-2008. And then from there, I was like, wow, I want to use that. Because like with that creativity in mind, I just felt like this is something that I want to use one day. So like in my mind, I was like, I want to use this one. I don't care how much it's going to take me. I don't care what it's going to take me to get there. But I just have that feeling of that. I just want to have to use it one day. So 3 years later, I came to my mother and I was like, I want to buy a computer. And she looked at me. She's like, what are you talking about? There's no money to buy a computer. There's no place where you can charge a computer. There's no place where you can learn how to use a computer. Like all those things. And to me, I was like, oh, wow. I mean, that's like, what am I going to do with it? You know, am I just going to keep it in the museum or things like that? There's not even money. But then because she was a mother to me, she didn't discourage me. She went, worked 3 years looking for $300 to buy for me a computer. So during those years, I even forgot about it. I didn't know that I even asked my mom for a computer. But after 3 years, she came and she was like, hey, no, this is $300. You can use it to buy a computer. That was a moment that changed my life. I was like, wow, like now what is next? So when will I try to, because the reality now comes to life. Now I have the money to work 3 years, looking for $300 in a refugee camp. Now I have to buy a computer. Now I have to find where to charge it. Now I have to learn how to use it. It was so intense. And then to me, and then I asked myself, I'm like, if my mother can work so hard for 3 years to find $300 to buy from the computer, how about if she can be able to, you know, flee the whole war to get us to a refugee camp? So how about using a computer? I also have my brothers that are following me. If I don't use this, next time the world are going to come to my mother and say, hey, I want something. And then you know what she's going to say? I bought one computer and he's not using it. So, you know, so I become like a block now to my brothers because I asked something that, so like those are things that I start thinking about. And then I start like, well, I got this, I'm going to use it. And then I start like doing research. So I found a place where I can be able to charge my computer. That is like a center in a refugee camp that I have to work 3 hours every day to go and charge my computer. And I would work every day, go charge my computer, come back home, listen to music, and then open the computer, try to use it. It was so hard. Even who's going to teach me? And then I started like downloading offline tutorials. And then like tutorial is just how to use, you know, Microsoft, how to open a computer, things like that. So yeah, that was actually the first time I interacted with a computer. And then from there, I mean, I know the worst thing used to be like, I would go to like charge my computer and I find that there's no power in the generator. And work 3 hours, I have to come back home. And that happened often, like almost 60% of the time. Like I would go there, the generation is not working. Sometimes it's gonna be raining on the way. It was just like, you know, it was just crazy. But I was happy with it. I was happy. I was like, because I was like the only kid in the refugee camp that had a computer. Like, so I was so happy with it. I did not care what else it took me to get there. But I remember like the first time I interacted with the video game was like my friend installing for me Grand Theft Auto on my computer. And then I came back home. And then I opened the desktop and I found like, this is a video game. I never thought video game were crippled by people. I just like, they just fall from heaven. I was like, what is this? And then I start like, you know, exploring it, using it. And then from the wow, like I was so happy with it. I enjoyed it. I was like the next thing I could do every single day. So then from there, that's where I found like really the power of games.
So how did you begin to learn to code? Because I mean, it's one thing to, mm-hmm. to learn how to use Microsoft, you know, the Microsoft mm-hmm. Office suite. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to learn to play games. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to build a game. So yeah. How did you start to learn to build games?
I think, yeah, that's a really good question. I think for me was finding my passion first. So my passion was actually my mission. So my passion came from my mission that actually forced me to code. So like, like in a way that, you know, when I started playing Grand Theft Auto, I realized that games are so powerful. I realized that games are really like, they're really amazing tool to tell stories because like they're interactive. So when I started playing the game, and then I realized that, you know, I'm from South Sudan, a country that has almost 73% of the population are young people. You know, they're all young people. Some of them were born in war, they were raised up in war. And even in Iraq, you can look at kids, you know, the only thing they know is violence, violence, violence. And then when I was playing Grand Theft Auto, I was like, wow, how about a kid in a refugee camp or somebody from South Sudan playing this game? They feel like that's how things are done. But how about making a video game that can help them make peace or can help them learn about stories or can help them educate themselves? So in that process of like playing video game, I began to like realize what is the power of game? What can I do? And then from there, I was like, wow, like I need to create my own game. And then that's when I asked myself, okay, what do I need to do to create a game? You know, how to code, I have to make sound, I have to do graphic design so that I can make it. There was so many things, so many things. So and then from there, okay, like what is the biggest thing I have to do first? Programming. So then I start like getting tutorials, offline tutorials, and then start like learning how to code. Like, you know, or it was like the hardest thing I've ever done in my life was programming. Like, it was like nobody's actually helping me to fix a bug for me. It was so hard. Sometimes I would just leave my computer for a week and then I don't touch it anymore. And then sometimes I would come back. You know, it was so crazy. It was just like, well, that moment that I had to like really dedicate myself, you know, working 3 hours every day. I was so tired. But then I started like learning to code offline tutorials. I had to like, you know, go get like a flight drive to like put all the offline because I don't have internet. And I kept on doing that. And then I created my first game. So now,
what language did you learn to code first?
C#, C++, Python. Yeah.
Okay.
But I think, So I started using that. It was like, I started really far. I thought I was going to do like, you know, Python part first, but then I was like, let me just do like C# and C++ because they are more like on game development. It's like the biggest thing. So I'm like, let me just do that. It was like, it was so hard.
How did you start coming up with sound and graphic design as well? Because so all of those things are very difficult, even in good circumstances. In good circumstances, those are difficult things to learn. So how did you start coming up with the ability to do sound and graphics as well?
Yeah, I had to like teach myself as well. I had to teach myself like graphic design at the same time. I had to like teach myself how to make sound. All those things I had to learn, like, you know, a lot, Adobe Audition, you know, I had to like learn, or like Photoshop, like everything. I had to like learn all of them. So for me to be able to like create my first game. Yeah.
It's a remarkable story. So when did your game start getting noticed by other people?
So I finished my game actually in 2016, right? That was around August 2016. So when I made my game in 2016, so I started like distributing to kids in the RPG camp, right? You know, sending via Bluetooth, you know, because there was no internet and things like that. But then around August, I thought of something really, I even don't know why I haven't thought about it. I was like, okay, maybe I need to like upload the game because the game was so small. It was really very, very small. So like, I'm like, maybe I need to upload it on my Facebook page as a picture. And then I would tell people, hey, I made a game. So, which is the most crazy idea, you know, what I've ever done. So, because it's an APK. So, but I'm like, let me just do it. So I upload the game. And then I was like, hey, I made a game. And then people started downloading it. The next day, it started going viral. Like everybody was sharing it. And I'm like, what is this? Like, I have no idea. So the next thing I'm saying is was like an email coming from somebody from Bali. And so he was like, I want to invite you to South Africa. And I'm like, what? Like, yeah, I want you to come and talk about your game. I just downloaded it. It's really a very nice concept. We want to like, my mind was like, and then the next day, email from like, you know, big game companies, like, you know, like a lot of people start like emailing me, like journalists start emailing me. It was just like, I don't know, but it was just like, it just something controlled it. It just went that way. And then from there, I went to South Africa. And then the next year, I was invited to come to San Francisco. So it was like a very, the journey was just like, the movement was just like that, you know.
Real quick, can you talk about the game a little bit? I almost forgot to ask you. Can you tell me the name of the game? And can you talk a little bit about what players were doing in it?
Yeah, so for the first game, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So when I made the first game was about peace building, right? So the game was like teach kids in the camp that like, you know, every solution is not violence. So what you have in the game, you have to like, you have to protect your community from being from hazard, from being killed, people from, so your focus as a player is protecting your community. So that was like the best, the basic concept of the first game. So now I'm working on a second version of this, of the first game, which is Salaam, the same game. So it's a game that actually put a player in the shoes of refugee. So it's a game that talk about the experiences and the journey of refugees. So what do you do as a player? You take a refugee from a war-torn country to a peaceful environment. And then for them to go to a peaceful environment, there is a lot of difficulties that you have to overcome on the way, you know. You have to give them water when they run out of water. You have to give them you have to give them food when they run out of food so that they can be able to, like, you know, so that they can be able to have, like, access to food so they can reach their final destination. It was like, it's just journey. It's a game that helps you understand exactly what the journey of a refugee is. And then the best thing you can do is the first game in the world whereby actually when you buy food in the game, you're actually buying somebody in the refugee camp food. When you buy water in the game as a player, you're actually buying somebody in the refugee camp water. So like all those things are the things that I'm working on the game and it helps people understand exactly what the journey of a refugee is.
That's amazing. What kind of partnerships are you, because that's a heavy lift. What kind of partnerships are you building to make that happen?
Yeah, there's a lot. So there's a lot of different partnerships I'm working on right now. I'm working with like local organization. So when the game is released, that's where we're going to be like, you know, sending the funding to like local organization based in a refugee camp. We're also having a partnership with the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, to be able to like monitor, evaluate the impact of the game. We also have like different partnerships because my company is a business company. So we have like different partnerships like Facebook Gaming, you know, Eisenberg, like different companies to make sure that the game is working. And actually the exciting news is that we're going to be working on a PlayStation version of the game as well. So it become like a home-based game. So those are things that, you know, I'm just working on as a refugee, you know, like, as I say, like I have the opportunities now to be able to like do the thing that I love, you know, do the thing that I'm passionate about. And also like, use my experiences to be able to like, you know, tell people about, you know, the flight of refugees. Yeah.
Do you have a sense, and I know that we're getting ahead of the story a little bit, but yeah, that's okay. Do you have a sense of when the game is going to be released, or is that still tentative?
Yeah. Before the end of the year, pretty sure around December.
That's amazing. I'm looking forward to talking more about that. Anyway, so back to the story, you were invited to South Africa out of the refugee camp. Can you talk a little bit about the process of actually traveling from the refugee camp to South Africa and what that meant to you?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was really, unbelievable. Yeah, for me, like, first of all, I was like, wow, like, this is something new for me. This is something like, even for me, like, you know, I need to get my passport, I need to get my visa and all those things. It kind of like took, I didn't take so much because like I had so much support and resources coming from the people that were actually inviting me. So that was really good. For me, it was just like the experience of like just leaving refugee camp for the first time and also like going to one of the best countries in Africa, like I've never, you know, dream of visiting before. Second to that, I was so nervous that I'm going to be talking about something that I built in a refugee camp. The culture is different. Even my English was like, you know, it was a different thing. I asked myself, what am I going to talk about? Like, it was just crazy. So I left the refugee camp, went to Kampala, get in a plane, go to Ethiopia, and then went to South Africa. That was like Johannesburg. And it was so different for me. Like the building, you know, people, like it was just amazing. Then I remember going to my hotel and then in the evening meeting all these game designers, like, you know, at the lobby, and everybody was talking. Everybody was like, and I met a lot of people that, you know, even later on, I didn't even know who these people are, but they're really, really very influential in the game industry. You know, people that are owning big companies and things like that. It was just amazing. I was so shy. I couldn't talk to people. My English was kind of like, you know, it was so hard. So I went there and then the next day I was giving a talk and then I was just, you know, talking about my game, what I was doing. And then after that, like, you know, everyone was coming to me and then we just talked. It was a very good, you know, networking event. And then just, you know, then went back to the refugee camp, you know, after 4 days, actually. Yeah.
So somewhere in there, you mentioned you were invited to San Francisco. That's, to me, is, if I remember right, that's a big part of your story and something that was, that seemed like it was going to be amazing. And then something happened. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, I remember like, yeah, after that, I went back to the refugee camp, and then immediately I was invited to like come to San Francisco at one of the biggest, you know, gaming festival, like Game Developers Conference. It bring like over 30,000 people around the world. It was like one of the big, it's like one of the biggest, you know, festival in the world. So for me, like I was invited and say, hey, Lord, you're going to be talking about your game. And I was like, wow, like I was so excited. I'm like, you know, coming to America was like the biggest dream of my life. And this time now, I was going to come not because of resettlement. I was coming from a perspective of like, I made something for myself. I create something for myself. And I mean, I'm being invited to come and, you know, meet all these game designers. And then I was really excited. And then, you know, the next thing that happened was the Trump refugee trouble ban. And that was like the same week. That was like the same week. And that was like the first day I tried to give up in my life. Like I almost gave up. I was like, no, I was really like, I was like, you know, my family have tried to like resettle to America to find better resources, but we could not for like in 20 years, 10 times be rejected for no reason. And then when I got my invitation, I was like, now, you know, I'm going to find my resources because of something that I work for, you know, not just being because of being a refugee, just being resettled or something. But then I remember like, you know, the Trump trouble ban, it was crazy, man. I almost gave up. And I remember coming back from home, I was like, I threw my computer down and I, you know, my mom came to me and she was like, yo, she was like, you know, why, what is going on? And I was like, I told her the story. And I was like, now I don't want to like do anything anymore. Like I'm giving up. I'm not going to program anymore because I don't see anything good coming out of this. You know, this is my best opportunity for me as a person to grow and also build my company. Like, what is going on? Like, why are they not, you know, getting any better? And I remember like my mother like looking at my eyes and she was like, you know, she was like, let me tell you something. Well, I'm like, what are you talking about? She was like, you know, we know that you cannot steal water from an ocean. I'm like, what do you mean? So like, you know, when you go to an ocean with a basket, like the biggest basket in the world, and then withdraw water from an ocean, it can never finish. It keep on overflowing, And I was like, what does that even mean again? So like, that's how you are as a person. There's a lot of opportunities in your life. You don't have to give up. You know, there are more coming on your way. You know, you don't have to give up. I know you struggle. I know you work so hard. I know that we work so hard to be resettled, it doesn't work almost in 10 years, in 20 years, never give up, keep doing what you love. Another day, like I will pick up my computer, then keep going. And it never took me a month before I got my second invitation to come to the US, which was actually better, you know, So I had to learn, you know, my mother's always been there as an inspiration for me to like really, to really like how we go through the thing that because we're human, we feel like giving up every day. And then you need the right person in your life to always like help you get up and keep doing what you do. And a lot of people ask me today, you know, hey, Lual, you're in DC, you know, you have your own game company or you study your own foundation, you know, you live in one of the best, cities in America, like, this like you're a very successful person, you know, like are you a self-made person? And I'm like, that's a very good question. But the day my mother bought for me a computer was the day that disqualified me to become a self-made person. Why? It doesn't matter what I'm doing today. Yes, there's so much work I'm putting into it. It was more than just buying a computer. But that day was a day that actually meant that somebody in my life, you know, realized what I can be able to do. And that the desire that created, you know, I'm here today because of all my partners that are actually working so hard to be able to be where I am, you know. So being a self-made person is never in my definition of life. Because like there are people in my life that helped me to be where I am. You know, there are people that gave me food. There are people that, you know, and they are really very important. And I went to, you know, entrepreneurial journey, you know, as refugees as well, you know, and things like that, yeah.
So you mentioned that you had a second invitation and that's the one that got you to the US What was the second invitation?
So what happened in the second invitation was actually, so there was an organization that actually having an accelerator program. Actually, I love talking about that. They had an accelerator program where they were actually selecting companies around the world that use the power of technology to bring communities together. And then from there, I remember connecting with the World Bank. And then they were like, the World Bank was like, wow, like, we need to bring you, we're going to help you with your visa, and then we're going to bring you to America. I'm like, okay, wow. So I came here, and then that's how I started my company. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's around the time that you and I first met.
Yes, exactly.
Because I remember we first met when I was running an event series on refugee challenges around the world. And so we had one that was about the Syrian refugee crisis, and we had one that was about refugees from Africa, and we had one on the Rohingya challenge. And I remember you came up to me right afterwards and we started chatting. And I remember thinking, I told my wife later, I just met the most remarkable person. And that's been a lovely thing that we've been able to continue this relationship over time.
I enjoy those conferences though. Like, I wish when the world comes back together, I wish we could do more stuff like that. Like there were, did we do that at the human right? Is it like there was a space in downtown near, like, I don't know where that space was. I remember we had a panel, right?
Yeah, we did. We did.
Oh, yeah. So
you joined a panel for that, and then the podcast later. But that was at Human Rights First, and that was in partnership with a couple of organizations. One was Human Rights First, and the other was Veterans for American Ideals.
Exactly. And
that's where I used to be a U.S. Naval officer, and that's where I linked up with them, was this Veterans for American Ideals, which was just, it was a wonderful partnership. And I feel the same way. I miss those kinds of events, and I miss those kinds of conferences. And when the world does come back, I look forward to being able to organize and participate in those again. I miss it so much. Yeah. So over the time that you have been in Washington, D.C., you have gone from being someone who was just arriving in Washington, and you had to find ways to navigate and build a life for yourself here. Can you talk a little bit about the process of navigating that and building yourself into someone who now has this massive reputation and are very well known? How have you done that?
Well, that's a very good, it's not a good story that make a good business. And it's not a good business that make a good story. Why? Because when I came here, I had a passion. I knew this is the only thing that I have. And the reason was because I wanted to make sure I connect with the right people that can be able to get me where I want to go. And so that has always been the prayers for my mother, to be able to connect with the right people that can help me, push me, and so on. I believe that, being in America is a privilege for me. It was a privilege for me. There's a lot of kids in the refugee camp that would actually love to be where I am today, and they would actually utilize the resources that I have, and to me it was, okay, like, I'm here now, what can I do next? I came here when I already have an idea of what the society look like, or what the community look like, or what I want to achieve look like. I did not come directly from a refugee camp and be overwhelmed by the thing that I found here, right? I came here knowing that, if I wanted a life like this, if I would just come here to not utilize the resources I have, I would go anywhere. I did not come here to be surprised by the tallest building in the world. I was not here to be surprised by living in LA or living in Washington, D.C. And I came here to understand what is the work and what is the value, what I can be able to contribute to whatever I can be able to bring to the table. And that's like, okay, this is a gay ministry. I'm creating something new. What are the best way for me to connect with the right people in this industry? Because it's a very hard industry. It's a very competitive industry. It's very hard. So, but for me, it was, okay, my biggest point here is like, let me put myself in a place where I can grow gradually and connect, like, you know, connecting like with people like you. You know, it was really amazing. During that time, I was able to learn every single day. I remember the first time we met that, you know, I was just navigating. You know, I remember, like, you know, and then the same year, I remember that's how I was. I got named the Global Gaming Citizen in 2018. It was like, it just go fast, and then stuff like that. So my biggest thing was just to make sure that I connect with the right people. And I also, like, use the resources and utilize everything that I was having, you know, to be able to get there and being able to, like, okay, what do I need as a person, as a business? I need to connect with people that are going to help me to maybe, like, what are the things that I need to learn when it comes to American business? Because it's a different perspective now. Like, it's not being in a running a business. Yeah, it's crazy. You know, a gross of making taxes, like a gross of, like, you know, being able to, like, all those things, being able to, like, you know, I had faith. Yeah, I had to, like, believe in the process. I also had to, like, you know that, you know, this is going to take time, but this is worth it. This is, like, I cannot make it by myself. I can make it by connecting with the right people that will get me to where I want to be. And I think that was the biggest thing that I've ever done great, you know, in my journey. Because if I couldn't do that, there's a lot of simple things that takes us away, you know. A lot of simple things that come and then we have gone. Like, we're just overwhelmed by life. But I think that being thinking about my family and having the right people, incredible mentors in my life that were able to mentor me and also give me advice to be able to, like, you know, keep going. Yeah. And then the rest is always there. You know, people will always follow what you're working on. You know, it's a society we live in. So people will always be there, like, to, like, you know, follow the journey, enjoy the journey with you. Some of them will not like it. Some of them will like it, but that's none of your business as a person. Just keep on growing. And then, it's been a great journey. I love it so far. I really like it. And I wish that there's more to come. You know, I feel like there's so much more that I need to do, like, and connect with more right people. Like, it's a marathon, you know, it's life. It's something that keep going. You know, no man is an island. You know, you can't do stuff by yourself. So you have to, like, have a community of people who support you, you know.
It's that is among the more difficult lessons, I think, even for myself, that this is a marathon. Mm-hmm. And you hit on two such critical lessons, like I just said, it's a marathon, and that you're not an island. And those are difficult lessons for people, myself included. Now, since I first met you, I've seen you across almost every major news organization. You've been on, I'm trying to think, you've been on CNN, you've been in the Washington Post, BBC, Al Jazeera, you have been everywhere. I wonder, can you talk a little bit about what that has meant to you, and what has that experience been like for you to essentially, I'm not sure I like using this word, but you're almost an influencer in a sense. Yeah. Like, what is that like? What have you made of it?
Yeah. So I'm glad you asked. I mean, to me, it was, first of all, like, it's an honor, you know. Recognition are good, you know, awards are amazing, everything amazing, but I think to me sometimes it's just sustainability. How do you sustain that life? How do you sustain, you know, because, like, as you said, they are news agencies, they are really amazing because people get to hear my story, you know, more people get to know about, you know, what I'm up to, more people are there to hear about, like, you know, what I am contributing to the world. You know, some people are like, you know, like yesterday, it's called NKH. It's one of the Japanese medias, like one of the biggest Japanese media around the world. And then they aired the interview like 2 days ago. Like, it's an interview I did with them. And people are emailing me right now from Japan, you know, people are emailing me from around the world, and they're like, wow, like, things like that. And the reason what I love about it is that, you know, it just, people get to hear different, I am able to amplify, you know, the voices of refugees. I'm not just going to be talking about my business. I'm going to be like, you know, telling people, hey, you know, refugees can be able to become entrepreneurs. They can be able to become anything they want if we have the resources, right? And to me, I don't value it. So I think to me, it's just like, it's okay, but it's not all I want. It's okay. Like, it's okay for my business. And I can tell you, this is like the best thing I've ever, like, we have over 200,000 people right now sign up for my game just because of all this, you know, because of the, you know, because of the media, because of the people, like, you know, following the journey. So in business wise, it's amazing. But personally, I'm more critical about it. Like, people begin to develop a certain idea of who you are, you know, like as a society. And then, again, like, I'm not going to live to people's perspective. I never thought that I would be in this environment before. So I'm just going to be like grateful for what I have today, making sure that like the social media life does not take me, because these are simple things that actually like affect us, especially in the generation we're in as a young person, Instagram, Twitter, all those things that are really amazing. They're good. I use them for my business, but my thing is, how do I then utilize it for good as well? You know, what kind of content am I supposed to put out there? What kind of, is that a content that is going to allow people to think of different of me? Or is it a content of that people can be able to like improve and help themselves? And I think that, as you mentioned it, it's really amazing to be out there. It's really good to be recognized. It's really good to be, because it helps you as a person that, you know, that is something that you're doing is needed in the world. You know, it's something that is needed. But then you think about, okay, it's already needed. Now, how do I sustain this now? Like,
how do I sustain this? Is it ever overwhelming? Do you feel like you're being pulled from every direction at this point? Is it ever sort of too much, the number of requests on your time now?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy though. It's been like crazy, but I'm enjoying. Yes, there are a few things that I'm enjoying. But I love when it comes to like public speaking now. I love it so much because like I feel like I'm actually developing something that I never thought before, like that I never thought of doing before. That, and that's like, you know, public speaking is amazing. And I never thought I was ever going to do it. But if I'm going to speak to like universities, you know, to like, you know, conferences and things like that. So I'm actually developing something out of my career, which is like being a public, you know, like, you know, somebody that speaks to people and also like giving them something they can be able to relate to, right? So, and those things that are always like, and it's so funny, like a lot of people sometimes, I tell them like, when I'm not making game, I'm most likely speaking, like those are like two things that I do. The reason is because I'm beginning to develop that passion again, because I feel like, you know, there is so much more that we can do. And I've never thought you mentioned a word, you know, you're becoming like an influencer. Like for me, I never thought of that before. But, you know, to me, I feel like even with public speaking, it's giving me an opportunity to actually share, because I've been in a space before where I feel like I wish I had a voice. I wish I had, you know, more people listening to what I say. Because the reason why I'm thinking about, because I feel like I have so many stories that I want to say, but because I don't have the platform, I'm just going to be with it, right? And to me now, I think I feel like, you know, in the future, as I'm growing, it doesn't happen in the morning, you know, you have to put in the work. You know, I'm not going to wake up in the morning and be like Dwayne Johnson, no, like, it's a process of, it's a work. So in the future, when I have, you know, when I'm developing something that people care about, and then that means that I have a platform where I can then, you know, support people that, you know, need to amplify their voices, you know, refugees and things like that, things that are happening in our society, things are happening in Africa, things are like happening somewhere. Because I'm building that community, a platform of people who love what they're following for, you know, what they want to like go for. So, yeah, I mean, those are the advantages of being out there But it has also disadvantages as well, a lot of disadvantages. So, you know.
Yeah, I'm certain there must be. So I know that as we come towards the end of some of our time here, one thing we had talked about the last time, probably a month or so ago when last we spoke, you had talked about how something that's really near and dear to you are challenges and issues relating to diversity and inclusion. And I wonder a little bit if you might be able to talk about what those concepts mean to you and how we might strive to enhance diversity and inclusion in our lives and our careers and our workplaces.
Yeah, this is really it's a very important question, especially in our time right now that we are in a way that, you know, I'm pretty sure that all of us, that doesn't matter where you work or where you live, or this is something that we have to always talk about, because this is something that is part of our life. And I wish we live in a society where we don't even have to mention it and talk about it. You know, like it's like diversity and exclusion. You know, you don't have to talk about it. Empathy. You don't have to even teach people about it. You know, like things like, but again, that's the world we live in. It's a world where you have to teach something. You have to let people experience something. And when it comes to inclusion, it's really, and the best example I can give about that is like, diversity is very important. Inclusion is very important because it helps us, companies or people, or like to be able to like create solutions to the communities where those people come from, right? They are also underrepresented communities. You know, they are communities that do not have resources. They are communities that are suffering from different ways. And there is no way you can be able to help them until you understand the problem that they're going through, right? There's no way you're going to give refugees what you want until you experience your life. And the only way is to actually include them. You can include them in decision-making. You can include them in anything. You can hire them, because when you hire these kind of people, they are going to bring solution to the problem that your company is planning to solve. You know, I was talking about this the other day with Jump City. So Jump City is one of the biggest gaming company in the world. It's actually like the CEO is a former co-founder of MySpace. So I had this conversation with Chris DeWolf, and he was asking me about like, what can we do as a company to be able to, I'm like, this is, I'm glad you didn't ask about it, because this is a really big this investment needed, you know, into like this, you know, this communities. And the reason is because one, as a person, as a refugee myself, if I wasn't a refugee, I would not be making real again today. I'm honest with that. I've never had an idea of like, why would I even think about making game to help refugees? Because I experienced it. You know, if they don't understand like where we come from as a person, even when you look at the game environment that I'm working on, the game environment, the characters, everything is about refugees. So I'm developing something that people feel that is how it is. So I'm including even how they live. And that's the same thing when it comes to like, you know, in America, like they're like, when, even the cultures, you know, like their big game where like, you know, their culture, when you look at the game, the characters is based on that culture. It's based because that's why like communities are very important. I'm not going to wake up and I'm not going to make a game about a culture in China because I don't know what that culture looked like. So, but for me to make that as a company, I need to hire somebody that understand that culture, that understand that way of living, that understand what kind of environment does it. Is it a tropical environment? Like, you know, environment, is it like, and that's why, because as a creator, and I'm going to say this, as a creator, I can create an environment where somebody is going to live for the rest of their life. An environment, I can create it because somebody is going to match itself. I can create a product where somebody is going to like enjoy for the rest of their life because based on what I created, right? And that's why like really diversity is very important in anywhere. Like, even when we talk about radio station, like for example, like in podcasts, we need to have people talking about it. How do we experience? What are the experiences as they grow up? What is the world culture? You have to like include all these people, because that is the only solution that we can be able to do to create actually a product that our communities care about. But then if you don't include these people, even in decision making, what happened? You're just going to ignore them. And then when you ignore them, you're creating a product that actually, I don't want to say it this way, maybe you're going to create a product that actually does not even match with the way of living, right? That's where attention comes from. No, you're using a different word. You know, you're using this, right? Like all those things. And that's why, like, if you had somebody in that community when you were making that decision making, that would have helped you to make the right decision. And I think those are things that we, like, that's why, to me, I think that's why, like, diversity is really, and inclusion is very, very important.
Absolutely. So I wonder, as you are heading into this critical year for you, and you are getting ready to release your game and this product that you've been working on for a very long time now.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your goals for the game and what you're hoping for when you release it later this year. What are your hopes, and what are you hoping that the game will produce, and what do you think you might be seeing from it at this time next year?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I love it. I mean, the game I've been working on for a very long time. I'm really excited to finally release it. I'm really excited to really release it, because like I'm also in the pressure. Like people want to play the game. People love it. Like when are you releasing it? Because like, you know, I was supposed to release last year, but because of the pandemic, you know, that has affected people a lot, which has also affected, you know, investment as well. You know, everything just changed, you know. The conversation after the pandemic, the conversation of investment changed from different people. Like, oh, maybe I want to focus on something different, you know. So that kind of like affected us as a company. And then we used that time to actually like, you know, focus on raising more funds. And now we're working like this. My focus is, like, as I said before, like, I want this game to be successful. I want this game to, you know, to be one of the best game out there. I want this game to be a continuous game. And I want to, like, help people understand, like, you know, have empathy, the fight of refugees and things like that. Then I want to start, like, maybe creating a new game, you know, after that. But when I release this game, I'm going to be working for it for, like, the next maybe 5 years, you know. Bringing new stuff, putting in different platform, having more people playing it. Like, that's, you know, what success look like to me, you know, like what I imagine, what I want to do every day, what I want to plan for. But, and then I'm just, and then just focus on my, and actually seeing how the game is actually helping people in real life in a refugee camp, you know, things like that. After I release it, I will have time to like focus on my foundation more and more. Yeah.
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah. I want to ask you maybe two more things. So can you talk just a little bit about your foundation?
So at least I actually launched my foundation last year. And our focus is actually to help to build technology schools in Africa. Not just in Africa, but for the you know, for right now, it's just building technology school in Africa to help refugees learn, you know, coding, you know, programming, you know, like graphic design, business, you know, demonstration, all those things. That's what my foundation is focused about. We partner with really big companies. So last year, we partnered with Western Eagles. That's where we got our first funding from. And then now we are partnering with Facebook, actually, which we are actually announcing sometime very soon in the next week or so. And then we are partnering with Coursera. Coursera is an online, you know, university where you can get, you know, courses and things like that. So we are partnering with Coursera so that refugees, they're actually giving over 500 scholarships to my foundation. So like,
that's amazing.
The reason is, well, yeah, like, I'm really excited. Yeah, I've been working so hard. We are also like partnered with Unity. So like, Unity is like, it's a game engine. It's one of the video game engine where people create video game and things like that. So we are partnering with them to like teach kids, you know, how to like, you know, code using Unity. That we are getting our funding there from as well. So my focus is just, I have this privilege now of like having these big companies, you know, and that's again, going back to inclusion, you know, like we are like, you know, the refugee communities out there, but like being included before, like we need to give them resources, you need, they need a quality of standard, you know, and that's the thing, like, you know, we are actually partnered with a company called Origin PC that make one of the best PCs in the world, like really, really best PC. So we're partnering with them so that they can give refugees actually all this incredible PC, powerful PC, so that they can actually start playing video games when they're in a refugee camp, you know, and then we give them internet, you know, then they start like a streaming game, you know, it's everywhere, people can watch them, so they can even really start, you know, look at the pandemic. I'm at my house right now, working from home. If a kid in a refugee camp had a good computer, all these peers, of the internet. Do you think they cannot work from home? They work from home. They can work from home. You know, and that's one thing that I'm really so passionate about, that my foundation can be able to do this and have all these opportunities. Having Coursera coming in, you know, they can be able to now study online, get any course from any university for 6 months, 1 year, and then they get it. You know, so these are things that I've always dreamed of doing, being able to like give, you know, following the footsteps of my mother. She looked at me, she, I don't know what the best word, she saw a potential in me that nobody ever seen before. And then, you know, I'm giving back the same, like, you know, I have all these computers in my house. I have all these computers in my house right now. Like, it's crazy, but it's only took one person to believe in me, to give me all I have today. So I think that's the focus for my foundation, to be able to like give our refugee resources, especially in education, like really, really in education, yeah.
Well, it's truly remarkable. I want to be mindful of your time, and I want to thank you so much for joining us. But let me ask you one last question. For listeners who are hearing from you, how can they be supportive? How can they help? Is there anything they can do that would be useful?
A lot. So many things we can do. I mean, like, you know, I'm going to say this, and I love this. You don't have to be a shadow to make a world a better place. Each of us have the role to play. The first one you have to do is, if you know a refugee that you know, you have to call them and tell them how amazing they are, how you have learned from them. Sometimes it's a good thing to just to talk to these refugee communities and just hearing their stories. But sometimes to me, it's more than that. I think we have to like really call them and tell them how amazing they are, how their cultures shaped you as a person. What have you learned from them, from their experiences? If you do that, you're making a world a better place. That's a very simple one. Second is that, you know, volunteering with organizations. There's a lot of, you know, organizations out there where you can be able to like, you know, volunteer with them, you know, teach and things like that. Third, you know, you can, you know, visit our website on luamentor.org and shoot out an email if you want to become a mentor, you know, because I don't know who's good, maybe someone who's very good at something, you know, you want to become a mentor. You know, that's another way of helping, you know. Now we have Zoom call, maybe you can, you know, mentor some of the kids that are even in my program just to talk with them. Good way of like, you know, of making a world a better place. You know, donate to like a different organization, you know, it's the best way to like, you know, to be able to like to help. So like for me, when it comes to like really asking people to help, I ask people a lot when it comes to invest in education. Education is the only thing that, you know, if you know somebody, and education, it's more than just donating money. It can be donating some items that you have. You may have a computer, you may have you know, access to like books, you know, you may have access to like, because I think that's where my goal is going to, if I meet the most powerful Tesla right now in the world and ask me like, hey, what? Tell me one thing that I want to do right now, and I will do it for you. And that is, I would say that I want you to invest in education because that helps you to realize that if you're in a refugee camp, you can be able to make your life better, you know, a better life. You can change your family life. My family is right now in Canada, you know, because of education. My brother's playing football. My other brother's doing computer science. My sisters are doing, so like their life changed because of education. It's not because of like someone giving us food every day. It's needed. It just doesn't need. I'm not going to go to school if I'm hungry. You know, I'm not going to sit on like, but those are like really important things. So I think education is really very important. And that's where when someone asks me what can you like, you know, tell people to help with education. And yeah, thank you so much. You know, especially something like this conversation is helping. It's a conversation somebody is going to listen and it's going to help them, you know, having organization like this, being able to organize things like this. Because that's the thing that we need in our community. And I think that like we need stuff like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, my friend, you are an amazing person. And not only have you shaped my life, you are shaping lives of people around the world in remarkable ways. So thank you so much for joining us. It is an honor to speak with you.
Thank you.